Hey, good morning. It's Thursday, and that means it's time for Perspectives on WFSU-FM. I'm Tom Flanagan. Thanks so much for tuning in. And, of course, you are always more than welcome to participate in the conversation by giving us a call at 414-1234 locally. It's 800-926-8809. It's long distance from you to Tallytown. And perspectives at WFSU.org is the email address. If you prefer to tweet, we got a handle there, too, which is at WFSU Perspective. You know, most of us can tick off at least a few names when someone mentions the phrase great Southern writers. Who's your favorite? Maybe it's William Faulkner, perhaps, Flannery O'Connor, Thomas Wolfe, Carl Hiaasen, a more contemporary Southern writer, perhaps. But fewer of us probably know how many great writers have been spawned in the area of North Florida's Big Bend and up into South Georgia and over into Alabama. This has been a seething hotbed of literary artistry for a long, long time. And so to take the history of this area and it's fascinating people and places and how they've been incorporated into some phenomenal literature, we thought would be a good topic heading into this holiday season when many of us are looking for some good books maybe to share with that special someone or maybe just to explore on your own. So let's talk some deep-fried Southern literature, Big Bend, Florida style this morning. We're joined by Tallahassee Community College professor Bob Holliday. Has long had a fascination with writers from this area. You moved down here in what, 2000?
Bob, moved down here in 2000. Right after this had nothing to do with me moving down here, but right after I picked up a book called The Other Florida by Gloria Jehoda, which has now become a classic on this part of Florida. And I've been at TCC for 5 or 6 years now. So it's this part of Florida, well, the whole Gulf Coast area is just so steeped in the history and the literature and the Southern mythology thing and so forth. And there's still a lot of really good writers coming out of here. FSU has one of the top creative writing programs in the country, and it's significant.
And I think someone who would know something about that program is sitting right next to you, and that is Dr. William Warren Rogers from Florida State University. Dr. Rogers, great to have you on. What's been your fascination, a good old Auburn boy like you, with this with the literature in this part of the country?
Well, I was affected. I've always been interested in reading and writing and trying to understand the South. And you can't understand it. It's like characters that Mr. Faulkner wrote about and talked about and said, and if you're not Southern, you can't truly understand it. And if you are Southern, you're confused by it. And so but just the quality of the writing, the men and the women, particularly I think the women, their creativity is so evident. And Flannery O'Connor and many of our contemporary writers now.
Gosh, Catherine Ann Porter.
Southerners, or Southern writers. And so it's all the South. When John C. Calhoun died, his death words were all the South, the poor South. That's what he said. And I guess that's true, but it's not really true. The South is a nation within a nation almost. I still think that. It's that different from the rest of the country. And maybe that's why writers from the South are so good, is because they're interested in their fellow man, and they're interested, and it's a transition in writing. It's different from urban writing. It's different from all the kinds of writing that go on. It's autobiographical to a large degree. That Southern writers just have a way of, my mother could do that. My mother could spend, she never went to a movie, and I used to take it to movies all the time, and her interpretation of the screenplay was twice as good as the screenplay. I mean, I think Southerners are just inherently inventive and have a great command of language and a great respect for language and for words. And that's what moves me and has moved me.
That great storytelling tradition that we seem to have.
Yeah.
Well, if you're looking for a great repository of an awful lot of this literature, can't think of any better place than Forgotten Coast Books in Apalachicola. And that's your place, Susan Wolf. How did you get into the bookstore biz?
Through the back door. I began to visit in the South. You know that there's that saying, I wasn't born here, but I got here as quick as I could. Visiting, and when I was here, I would buy books from Downtown Books in Appalach, a wonderful bookstore with a lot of Southern literature and history. And when I ran out of money for books, I would go to the library. And the librarian recommended Alexander Key's book, The Wrath and the Wind, as something that I should borrow and read. And I was entranced by it. But it was out of print, and I thought, how on earth do you get a copy of a book? I want this book, and it's out of print, and we can't really steal it from the library because they have my number on file now. So I began to research out-of-print books, and his is a wonderful example of literature that is significant in depicting a certain time and flavor of life, but becomes unavailable. So my response to that was to start an out-of-print bookstore, or use an out-of-print bookstore, and collect these things that are no longer necessarily popular, but still have this wonderful insight and picture of a time.
Most of us, I think, have been, on occasion, looking for something that we remember or we have heard about, but, as you said, is out of print. It is no longer available. And in the case of someone like Alexander Key, first, who the heck is Alexander Key? For those people who have never heard of this great Southern writer who is very, very close to home as far as our location. Bob Holliday, who's Alexander Key?
Key was a very interesting person. He was a Maryland native, first of all, and he is best known. First of all, he's best known as an illustrator. That's how he started out, illustrating other people's books with these very lush kind of pen and ink drawings and so forth. He is best known today, believe it or not, probably for a series of children's books, really science fiction children's books that he began writing in the early 1960s and continued until right up into his death in 1979. The most famous of these books is Escape to Witch Mountain, which you probably know because Disney made a movie of it, and it's been filmed two or three times. So he spent the end of his life writing these sort of science fiction children's books about, you know, extraterrestrials being separated and from their community, and there are some constant themes that go through all of his book. But he lived in Apalachicola right before World War II, and then immediately after World War II. And while he was in Apalachicola, he wrote two adult novels. He wrote a bunch of short stories and so forth too for the pulps back in the 30s. But he's only got two adult novels, two adult pieces of fiction, historical fiction. The first one, which Susan reprinted two or three years ago, is called Island Light, which has to do with Reconstruction and an ex-Confederate soldier trying to reclaim property and things like that. But Wrath in the Wind, which is his first novel, is really a great book, and I think, as Dr. Rogers was saying before we went on the air, is ahead of its time in dealing with the issue of slavery and the issue of race, well ahead of its time. It's a novel that's set in – and stop me if I'm talking too long, please. It's a novel that's set in Apalachicola and St. Joe, which were before the Civil War, were competing with each other for I guess, supremacy in the Gulf Coast cotton trade. Dr. Rogers knows much more about that than I do, and it's about the illegal slave trade. Because, you know, the United States outlawed the slave trade way back in 1808, but an illegal slave trade, smuggling in slaves, continued right up until almost the Civil War. And so this novel, central character in this novel is someone who engages in this illegal slave trade and makes lots of money doing it and so forth. And it's got, I think, pretty explicit religious overtones, Sodom and Gomorrah and both of these towns being punished for their complicity in the original sin of slavery and so forth.
But all historically accurate then, Dr. Rogers, right? This novel, this narrative overlaid over real factual stuff.
It's brilliant. Because he said, writes things and says things that just aren't being written about or said even now. I mean, about the racial thing. It's incredible. And he loved nature. He loved nature. And what more beautiful spot could there be than Apalachicola? There is no more beautiful place in the United States. There really isn't. And his descriptions are vivid, and his descriptions are accurate, and you can read it and think about, I thought that myself. And a lot of that translates into our own psyche, because we say to ourselves, that's right. And it's brilliantly put, brilliantly. He's a great stylist, I think, a terrific stylist. And relatively unknown and unappreciated by the mass of people. But I think that once you read some of his writings, you become a convert immediately.
Dr. Rogers has been partner in a small academic publishing house here in Tallahassee called Century Press for, I don't know, 30 years now. And he had expressed an interest. Century Press publishes a lot of historical academic books and so forth, but over the years he had expressed an interest in reprinting The Wrath and the Wind, but there were copyright issues and so
sure.
forth, and then Susan got involved.
Well, we'll talk more about that as Perspectives rolls on. 214-1234, give us a call. We're talking about Southern literature, Big Bend, Florida style. We'll be right back. Lots of great literary art coming out of the Big Bend area of North Florida over the years, and we're talking about some of that art here on Perspectives. 414-1234, local number 800-926-8809. If it's long distance, and Perspectives at WFSU.org is the email address. Let's go to the phones now. Bob is patiently awaiting on line one. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Tom. You have a couple of folks on your panel that, as I say, were vaccinated with phonograph needles, as I have been, so I'm going to try to keep my comments just real, real brief. If anybody wants to ask any questions, I'll be happy to respond to them, but I just want to be as brief as possible. One of the authors that I really appreciate is a guy named Kirk Munro. He was a New Englander. He wasn't a local person, but he wrote juveniles back in the late 1800s, and he wrote lots and lots of stories about Florida, one of which I came across when I was in junior high school called Wakulla. And it is the most fascinating book, and over the years I thought several times about reprinting it. It's in the public domain. But I just never got around to it, and somebody else has now. So anybody that wants to see that book can get it. But it's just the most marvelous book written back, as I say, in the 1800s of a family that came down to St. Mark's. And anybody that was around when they put the spray field out east of Tallahassee that had read that book would have said, wait a minute, that ain't going to work. Read Wakulla and see what the topography of this place looks like. The other thing I was going to say is there's an outfit now called the Gutenberg Project, and any book that's out of the, it's in the public domain is accessible. It's really, really interesting, and I can't tell you anything more specific, but if you just Google that, you can find it. And the other two other things, Gloria Jehoda used to be my neighbor two doors over, and she worked with a guy named Val Martin in Salerno, who has had and still has a printing company, a press called Florida Classics. And a long, long time ago, he realized that there was a whole bunch of books around that were really, really good books about Florida, but had gone out of print. So he set about getting permission to reprint them, and he's still around. So anyway, that's what I wanted to contribute to the program this morning.
Well, thank you, Bob. We sure appreciate that. So it is possible then, isn't it, Susan Wolf, to get a hold of books that have been out of print and go into a reprint of them?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, it's just amazing, particularly those books that are in the public domain. That's really easy.
Yeah.
If the copyrights are still in effect, you can still do it. And Val, most of the stuff that he printed in Florida Classics, the copyrights were still in force, but he was able to cut deals, or, you know, make arrangements rather than cut deals to do that.
Well, thanks, Bob. Again, appreciate the input on that. So, but is that a growing concern, though, since many of these books, Susan, aren't really that well known, to reprint and then try to market them? Is that even viable?
As far as marketing them, I'm not sure how you gauge the interest, but it takes someone who discovers something, and we're told all the time about interesting books by people who come into the store. Both of these books somehow missed being updated in the copyright process, and my theory has always been that when Alexander Key left Apalachicola and moved to a different genre of literature, kind of forgot about them, so that both of these were in the public domain, although that generally wasn't known. And I needed to go through the Library of Congress and have them do some research to establish that. But once you've established that, then you need to decide if you want to use a certain printer, or if there are print-on-demand places now. There may not be someone who wants to finance it, and in this case, I've financed these myself just out of interest. But people are interested in these, particularly in the area where we're selling them in Apalachicola.
The Wrath and the Wind will be out probably next March. Is that what we're anticipating?
That's what we're hoping, yes.
Well, Tallahassee is, I guess, a receptive and quite a good book market. But Apalachicola, on a per population basis, a per capita basis, is incredible. Just walk into that bookstore before her bookstore came in, it was remarkable. It was almost a stampede. You'd think they were selling popcorn or something in there instead of books. And the response there is so vigorous. It's strong to you, to the good work you're doing, and to the work this other. What's the name of that bookstore?
Downtown Books is the other bookstore.
It's great.
Yeah, you look at a town the size of Apalachicola supporting two independent booksellers. And here in Tallahassee, you know, we got the Books a Billion out there on Thomasville Road, and of course Barnes & Noble and the Tallahassee Mall, and the poor paperback rack, they're going down now apparently for the third time. They couldn't make a go of it. And in a town with this educational level and affluence, you would think, golly, there'd be no problem supporting independent bookstores. But look at Apalachicola. My gosh, Susan, that's great.
I get some of my best books in Tallahassee at the Goodwill bookstore.
Absolutely. And Goodwill throughout this part of the state has a wonderful network of dedicated bookstores, and you can find treasures there for just a few dollars. You don't have to pay shipping and handling to come from one of the large online dealers, although that's a great place for identifying used and out-of-print books, too. And there are probably 6 to 10 very easy-to-access used book sites that you can go to on the web and also look up whatever strikes your fancy.
One of the interesting – one of the things that makes this whole situation interesting is technology. On the one hand, we have the Gutenberg Project where everything is getting digitized. On the other hand, when you used to do a book like this, you'd have to print several thousand copies and store them in your house or in your basement until you sold them all. But now you can do shorter runs on a lot of these things and print on demand, which actually makes it more economically feasible to do things. To do things like this.
Mm-hmm. Email in from Ken. He wanted us to repeat the name of the books by Alexander Key, particularly the one that has Wrath in the title, which is, of course, The Wrath and the Wind, which, again, coming out in April. This one, Susan?
March, hopefully.
March, okay.
Of 2014.
We're trying to coordinate it with the literary event that they have every year in Apalachicola that the library puts on down there called Authors in Appalach. Katie Green, the librarian, is in charge of that. And probably be two books coming out about the same time. This one and then the library is also publishing a history of Apalachicola up to the Civil War written by one of Dr. Rogers' students. And both of these are fine books.
Okay, and
classics, as a matter of fact. His dissertation, as I said, had been ponied on by all kinds of writers, including myself, and I've spent 35 years trying to persuade him to publish it, and here in a moment of largesse, based on her charm, he turned the whole thing over. And the format, though, again, thanks to her and her insight, she said, well, wouldn't it be good if we could have a three-part introduction? And she graciously asked me to write the one about the overview of the whole area, and Bob to write – he is an intellectual historian, actually, quite a good one – and to write
about
a profile on Key. And his place is neglected place in American literature and Southern literature, and then called on Lee Willis, who recently he's up there in Yankee land, and he's on a research grant writing on slave smuggling. And Bob was saying that it came in 1808. No more slaves can be imported to the United States. Ha ha ha. Cotton is just getting started in the South. There's a cotton explosion with the invention of the cotton gin and all of that. And so naturally you had people, and very little has been done in the way of research on slave smuggling, and yet Lee Willis is writing and has written one of the three introductory pieces. Then we're going to plunge into the book by Alexander Key. But that's a very imaginative innovation to have three introductions to a book, and that's what it's going to be. And thanks again to this good girl.
Bob Holliday sent me the manuscript here for that triple intro there. It really puts the book in, I think, a great context. These are introductions you want to read before you dive into the narrative of the book itself, I think, because it really sets the stage and lets you know exactly who this person is and the connection to history that this novel tale is going to be set in, which I think is just – it captures so much, and the dialogue is just spectacular. Well, Dr. Rogers, you got a great book here too, Victorian Thomasville, some pictures, some photos I have never, ever seen. Where did you come up with these things?
Well, thanks to the – I've been writing on about Thomasville since the late 1950s, and actually have written several books about the history of Thomas County and Thomasville. And they have a wonderful – they are more members of the Thomas County Historical Society than they are members of – several times just Thomas County would have more members than my home state of Alabama, the Alabama Historical Society has. That shows what kind of interest there is. And so I think that she is making a major contribution in publishing the first book about it and publishing this book and her, I'd have to say, brilliant idea of a triple introduction to it. And I think that once people discover what a fine writer he is, that the book will sell. That's what I hope it does. But if it doesn't, I'm still proud of it. And well, we'll see.
Should be. The amount of history in this area that is now being uncovered through works like this is fascinating because we have had, of course, historians, legitimate scholarly historians documenting different parts of this region for many, many years. But there seems to be more insight into the history, into the people, into the background of this area through these books than perhaps some of the more linear kinds of scholarly history books that you would find in a place like Strozier Library. And, well, why do we think we have all maybe better insights of a region through Southern writers than maybe other parts of the country?
Well, I think part of it's because the South, I think as the poet Alan Tate once said, the South really did not decide to join the modern world until after World War I. And for so long, it was frozen looking over its shoulder toward the past, and then it sort of made this leap into the future. So there was this collision of time periods and so forth. I think one of,
and the whole idea about the South is the South has always been poor. And poverty, and for lack of something better to do, a lot of people write, and they have visions. Little kids, I want to be a writer, and that's what they try. And Southern people, it's just in their blood. They love to write, and my grandson is... He's also fancies himself to be an actor, but he's acted in The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. That's what they live in Athens, Georgia. But he is just absorbed with history and absorbed with being a writer. And his little brother just won a spelling bee. And he says, see what I can do. And so there's just this understanding that Southern people were always poor and they spent times writing about their neighbors who they are very introspective and they are very descriptive of situations and the value of human relationships. That's what I think is part of the clue to understanding this outpouring of writing by Southern writers.
Yeah, I'm thinking of a more contemporary writer from right here in this area, a gal by the name of Rhett Devane. Talk about a good old Southern gal from Chattahoochee originally, and most of her books are set in that area, you know, around Chattahoochee. And boy, you really get a feel for that place in about, you know, 2.5 pages. You have locked into what that location is all about and what those people are all about. But we seem to be also so, I guess, focused on tradition here in the South, where, as you said, Doctor, you've got many, many years of poverty where you really don't have a lot. So you got to hang on to something. And maybe some of these traditions and customs and ways of doing things, that's something we can hang on to. They can't take that away from us, right?
I think that one reason a lot of these writers are neglected in the 21st century is that they were writing about issues and taking, I won't say, taking a point of view on issues like race that are simply not politically correct today. I mean, can you imagine? I think Faulkner would have had a hard time getting published today with some of the things he wrote.
Talk about – tell them your impressions on I'll Take My Stand. That
well, I mean, there was this there was a great period of what we call the Southern Literary Renaissance between the end of World War I and – roughly 1950, that brought us people like Faulkner and Eudora Welty and Thomas Wolfe and so forth, but it also brought us a collection of poets and critics out of near Vanderbilt called the Vanderbilt Agrarians. And they started out most of them being poets and fiction writers. Robert Penn Warren was one of them, but they later got into this, they later began to advocate the idea that the modern, and I'm going to phrase this very carefully, the modern corporate industrial state was by its nature corrosive, corrosive to identity, corrosive to the kind of leisure that is required to write great literature. That it turns the culture into one that is obsessed with the acquisition of wealth and so forth, and that this sort and that they and when this very famous book of theirs came out in 1930 called "I'll Take My Stand," they were basically warning the South not to follow the rest of the nation down this path. It's very controversial.
It looks like it. That advice wasn't totally taken to heart.
It wasn't taken at all.
414-1234 for Perspectives. We'll be right back. Great Southern writers. Right in our very own area. Who'd have thunk it, huh? Here on Perspectives this morning, we're talking about some really phenomenal literature that's been produced by people here in this part of the country, in the Big Bend area of North Florida and up into South Georgia and over also into Southeast Alabama. Susan Wolf with the Forgotten Coast Bookstore in Appalachia. By the way, how big is your place? Susan, I didn't even ask.
It's very small, actually, probably less than 2,000 square feet. But we've got a lot of wonderful examples of different kinds of Southern writing. And
who are your personal favorite authors, do you?
I'm very fond of two Tallahassee authors, actually. Lynn Marsh Allam, who's a Lou Ann Fogarty character. Moonlights for the Sheriff's Department while teaching at a community college during the day. And Adrian Folkeline, who writes some wonderful, sensitive children's books, really for young adults. And in both of them, there's a very rich sense of the area. Family is very important in the story. Allam writes incredible information about the porous land around Linn County and that area with the swamps and the sinkholes. And she meets my criteria of someone I'd like to read her stories because there's no chance I'm going to strap on scuba gear and go dive in the swamps. But she really puts you in that place and carries you through the rich ecological history. Her characters are wonderful with a Cajun character that includes a lot of storytelling and swamp lore. Jack Rudlow has been able to straddle both nonfiction writing. Both he and his wife wrote a lot about the coast and biological marine biology things, but they also wrote some wonderful fiction. Potluck is about a shrimp boat captain who gets drawn into the drug trade and needs to get back out. And they also wrote something called The Chicken Wars, which is pure fantasy. But after about the first chapter, you're going, oh, yeah, I could really buy into this. So just wonderful storytellers.
That's the best fiction that just pulls you in and suddenly it's real.
Mm-hmm.
Susan, I know that being on this show is going to cause an upsurge in people wanting to pre-order The Wrath and the Wind. So why don't you tell them, in case they want to, how to contact you?
I suppose they could send – we do have an email. It's swolfe@forgottencoastbooks.com. And if they express their interest, we don't really have a form yet or a way for them to order it, but we'll make a note to let them know when we have that material available and send them a form they can fill out and send back.
Yeah, and a good excuse just to drop down and see your store. I mean,
sure.
Come on.
Sure.
There's going to be a limited edition of this book, limited edition hardback. The first, 100 copies, the three of us who did the introduction are going to sign it, and then – all of the first run, I think, are going to be probably numbered. So it's be a collector's item.
A collector's item, yeah.
And unlike some of the companies that simply do text, we're including the illustrations of Alexander Key as part of the reprint.
Ah, okay.
And that was really one of the things he was best known for. Once you see his work, you can spot it in other places as it crops up. So that sets these books apart.
4141234 for perspectives, Southern writers and literature, particularly in this neck of the woods, is what we're talking about. 800-926-8809 if it's long distance. Bill's on the line right now. Let's go back to the phones. Hey, Bill, welcome to Perspectives.
Thank you very much. I'm a writer here in Tallahassee, and I've been attempting to just hold a dialogue with people around the history of historically black colleges and universities. And the history of their origins here in the South, their beginnings, and beyond the slave period or beyond 1619. And it seems as though there's this catch-22 of this is the identity of this region. It's the identity of the people, but at the same time, there's a rejection of the history. No one wants to talk about it because of the ugliness of it, the violence, the discrimination. But well, yet,
excuse
time,
me, let me interrupt you just for a minute to recommend someone.
Okay.
Joe Richardson. He's written on Fisk University and has written on the black person in the South. And is extremely well knowledgeable, and he's retired from FSU now.
Mm-hmm.
But his look for the name Joe Richardson in the library, and he has quite a bibliography. And I'd just like to recommend him to you.
Thank you.
Do you think that historically, Bill, the HBCUs in this area? Excuse me, FAMU, certainly in specific, has gotten short shrift as far as writers and the chronicling of its history is concerned, or what?
Well, if you look at it, again, there's this catch-22 of the history of Jim Crow, situation in the South is black people were forbidden by threat of violence from promoting themselves, from self-promotion or competition or development of economic, political, or social power. that couldn't even be done. And at this point, it's what has been learned by this institution and the people who are around it. Is the expectation is that you do not raise your head up, you do not look people in the eye, you do not compete with other non-black institutions. And it is literally the history, but yet and still in our attempt to transcend it, we refuse to examine it.
Okay, good point. And let's throw that open here to the panel as far as the way that different writers, particularly in this area, and you had mentioned specifically what Alexander Key had done, a rather progressive or different way of looking at race relations in a historical context.
Well, John, the book by Larry Rivers. Larry Rivers, who was at FAMU for many years and is up in Georgia now, as I understand it, teaching.
I think he may have just moved back to Tallahassee.
He may have. Well, anyhow, he has done a brilliant history of black history in Florida.
He
explores many of the things that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't know his book, I highly recommend it to you.
I'd like to echo that. Dr. Rivers is one of the great historians of slavery and slave resistance in this area. He's got two books, one of them, Slavery in Florida, but then he's got one that came out just last year called Rebels and Runaways, about slave resistance in Florida. And I mean, these are really great books, and I've been trying to meet Dr. Rivers for some months now. So if you're listening to this show, I want to meet you.
He is a great, great, great guy, and has made major contributions and is still making them. He's probably got four or five more good books in him.
Yeah. Dr. Rogers and Dr. Rivers were on was it in the 90s? They were on a legislative committee that was appointed to examine the incident, if that's what you want to call it.
At Rosewood
in the 1920s, and they worked together on that.
Well, it surprised me. This happened just this past week. It doesn't pertain directly to literature, but instructive perhaps in some of the the mindset and those Southern traditions we were talking about before, over in Columbia County, where the Department of Environmental Protection was trying to get a handle from the citizens of the area where perhaps to put a Union memorial on the old Alusty battlefield.
Hmm.
And instead of discussing where it should be, the conversation quickly became, should it even be there at all? More than 100 people came out, and they were very upset at the thought of having what they perceived to be an enemy memorial put on their hallowed Confederate ground. And I think it really surprised a lot of folks that still there is a fairly pervasive undercurrent, at least in some parts of the South, including this part of the South, that
guilty conscience,
you know, that the Confederacy still lives.
Supposedly at Alusty, there was massacring of the black soldiers by the Confederate forces. That's, I'm sure, was the central point that they were arguing about.
Yeah, there were,
but
atrocities.
Actually, Alusty is a great, great victory for the South. The South only had about two for a long time. But Alusty was a great victory. And whether or not you can hear both sides of it, that there was or was not a massacre of black slaves, of blacks who were Union soldiers there. That's, I'm sure, the central point that they were arguing.
One of the most interesting things when you study history is that you learn it's not a solid, fixed thing. And in fact, literature and history look at and interpret things in kind of a new light each time a new author deals with something. And that's what makes some of these things so still alive today as works of literature, that you can see the thinking of the person and the philosophy and compare it to your own views and to other contemporary views. Key's The Wrath and the Wind deals with greed and lust and economic exploitation. There is a financial bubble, and the banks go bankrupt.
And what it reminds us, what his book really reminds us of, and many, many people don't like to think about this, is that slavery, American black slavery, was a product of the market capitalist system.
And those forces, to some extent, still are current today. The exploitation of the environment. He's setting in 1840, the themes that he raises are things that you read about in Carl Hiaasen today in contemporary literature. And it's always changing. So now, for example, we have a black president, and the way people are responding to that reflects a lot of their own tradition and literature. I wish I were going to be alive in 50 years to see how people will write about our times.
And like you said, Dr. Rogers, it's kind of very instructive to see where you've been as you try to figure out even where you are right now. And so chronicles like Alexander Keyes, novels though they be, fiction though it may be, is still based on that reality. And that can help inform us as to exactly where are we now and what are we experiencing. So it's a, let's talk again about what's coming up here in Apalachicola, the great fun fest that's going to be a celebration of these great writers and others.
They normally hold this in October down there, but Katie Green, the librarian, is trying to get book dealers, particularly antiquarian book dealers, to come and set up down there and have more of a I think a book presence, but she normally has a featured author. I think Jeff Shara has been it in the past, for example. Panel discussions, talks, things like that, readings, things like that, and it is slowly growing, I think, into some prominence. I mean, it's Apalachicola, of course, is just a great town anyway to have this kind of thing. And the fact that it's going to coincide more or less with the publication of these two books, I think it's gonna just sort of add something to it. If you want more information on authors in Appalach, you should call the Apalachicola Public Library and ask for its director, Katie Green, C-A-T-Y Green. And I do not have her phone number or email address on me. But
they have an excellent website that can be accessed.
She's a extroverted, to say the least, woman who believes passionately in literature and in promotion of Apalachicola. I meant to, that I have never met anybody in Apalachicola who wasn't a character. They all are characters, and she is one. She personified. She has a remarkable energy, and to say the least, and is dedicated to her subject.
Well, what was the conventional wisdom, I guess, that the entire coastal region, from Louisiana all the way over probably to Tampa Bay, was settled originally by rogues and scoundrels? So.
And to include Texas in that.
People on the make, to be sure. People on the make who saw an opportunity.
And we haven't even talked about it. It would take the whole course to talk about the issue of blacks in Florida being runaway slaves and Americans going south to get back their runaway slaves. That is a huge issue. And the runaway slaves intermarried with Indians.
With the Seminole Indians.
Seminole Indians who were runaways themselves from the upper south to become Seminoles.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
The Department of State, as we've gotten to the anniversary, have been creating things like the Florida Spanish Heritage Trail, the Florida African American Heritage Trail. Dr. Rogers isn't going to like this, but my proposal is that they create the Andrew Jackson Atrocity Heritage Trail, because beginning in Pensacola and going all the way across the state, Andrew Jackson made his name by invading Florida at the behest of a lot of Georgia plantation owners trying to return runaway slaves who had fled to Florida, which was free then.
And had a very controversial justification for it. He did it on his own without that permission.
Well, folks, it has been a fascinating discussion. Dr. William Warren Rogers, Bob Holliday, and of course, Susan Wolf, thank you all for coming and talking about Southern literature, North Florida style, here on Perspectives, which is provided as far as technical assistance concerned by Taylor Cox and Lydell Rawls there too. I'm Tom Flanagan. Please join us next week for more Perspectives.
Audio copies of Perspectives are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. Log on to WFSU.org for online archives and podcast. Perspectives is a production of 88.9 WFSU-FM, Tallahassee.